The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Decommission Day by Katie Hummel. Time to Die Day. Well, probably today. I thought I was going to die yesterday, too, and look how well that turned out. But today certainly felt more promising. Before I shut down last night, R88108 from Logistics had informed me that the F2 line was on the schedule for decommission tomorrow morning. He definitely wasn't supposed to have access to the decommission schedule. Humans know it makes bots antsy. But he owed me a favor, and I didn't press the matter, so he's been keeping me posted all week. The F2 line has been on the decommission list for the past 3 months, but not until this past week did it finally get added to the schedule. And according to R88108's intel from last night, assigned a time slot of 9 this morning. My appointment with Oblivion was official. There was only one thing left to do. I left my charging pod and took the lift up to Deck 24, where the mess hall was located. The mess hall was really an atrium that opened up across Decks 20 to Deck 24. Deck 20 was where the cafeteria was located, along with a few smaller convenience stores and shops, which made Deck 24 the perfect spot to people watch. To be clear, I don't watch people for fun. I'm not one of those creepy bots that hang around public spaces when I'm starved for entertainment. I just needed to say goodbye to someone from afar without them noticing. I promise it's not weird. I picked a charging port to stand next to help me seem less conspicuous while I surveyed the mess hall below. The charging port wouldn't even work for my model. It was for small dust bot use only, but most humans don't know the difference between an LDAP and an MDAP charging point, so I figured I was safe. It wasn't uncommon for bots to pass through the upper levels of the mess hall to get from one end of the ship to the other, but I didn't want to risk raising suspicion. Luckily for me, though, I don't have to keep the act up for much longer. Within seconds, I spotted Nori seated at a circular table by herself at the far side of the mess hall, closest to the cafeteria, eating a chocolate chip muffin and reading Spaceport 21 Daily News on her school-issued tablet. She looked like her usual self. Same braided black hair, same navy blue uniform, same yellow book bag resting at her feet. At 12 years old, she was one of the smartest human children I've ever met. Not that I've met a lot of human children. My line of work in the search and rescue division doesn't exactly allow for lots of one-on-one chit-chat with kids. But I've hung around enough mess halls and rec centers to know she was different from most of the humans her age. She certainly was the only human I knew whose best friend was a bot. Hey, F2 unit, you looking for something? I turned and saw a male ship officer walking towards me. So much for masquerading as a dust bunny. No, sir, just passing through. Carry on, then. Yes, sir. I turned for one last look, but Nori had already gone. I didn't expect my socially distanced goodbye to take very long at all, but a mere 30 seconds felt quite unfair. 3 years of history together constituted at least 5 minutes of distance farewell time, but I suppose a particularly bored ship officer had other plans. I'd sigh if I could. To appease the officer, I pulled myself away from the railing and started walking toward the starboard lift bank. Just as I was about to step inside the car, an alert from command flashed across my terminal. F2 units report to Deck 11 for decommission. Leave all personal items behind. The Star Dune Company thanks you for your service. R88108 had it right after all. 10 minutes later, I stood in front of a large bay door on Deck 11 with about 100 other F2 units waiting to scan in further processing. The packed antechamber was eerily quiet for a bunch of metal humanoids shuffling about. I checked and even rechecked the online communications channels, but those were silent too. Not a single F2 unit showed any signs of any kind of online activity. Highly irregular and unnatural for a race whose sole reason for existence was to be chronically online. I suppose the whole marching to our death thing had everyone a bit stressed out. Another 10 minutes passed, and I was almost at the front of the bay entrance when I noticed a black head poking out from behind a support beam. Nori? Over here, Nori waved frantically. I left my spot in line and walked over. I wasn't the least bit worried about being followed or drawing too much attention to myself. When bot chatter hits zero activity, you know no one gives a dang anymore. Nori, what are you doing here? I asked. Why aren't you in school? How did you even get down here? Nori dismissed the question with a wave of her hand. You're not the only one who has friends in logistics, you know. That was the vaguest answer if I ever heard one. So, she continued tentatively, decommission day. Decommission day, I repeated it. I had filled Nori in on what decommission was years ago. I explained that there would come a day when my model would become outdated and my company, Star Dune, would need to retire my parts, including the hardware housing my memory module. As part of the decommission process, the data from my memory module, the module responsible for retaining all my life experiences, would be uploaded to their proprietary servers one last time, and then wiped completely clean, and the bot best friend as she knew it would cease to exist. She's probably asked me about 100 different questions regarding the decommission process over the course of our friendship, wondering where my parts went, stripped down and repurposed, where my data went, an encrypted server somewhere on the ship, why Star Dune couldn't give her a copy of my data, intellectual property, why I couldn't just run away, kill switch, why she should never talk about plans to save me, conspiracy charges, why she couldn't steal my data, theft charges. Why on earth the 25-year-old janitorial bot on Deck 5 is still kicking around? That one I never did find an answer to. You said you would say goodbye, Nori said when the day came. You said you would come and say goodbye before you left. She crossed her arms and looked up at me, challenging me to deny it. I know. I dipped my head in an apology. But what I didn't know was how to tell her that her F2 search and rescue bot friend of 3 years, a bot created and trained to operate under the harshest of planetary conditions throughout all 9 star systems, was a complete and total coward. I tried, I relented. I came to see you at breakfast this morning in the mess hall. Really? What time? I must have just missed you. You left early. All right. Nori shifted uneasily on her feet while her eyes scanned the emptying antechamber behind me. Why leave early? You didn't get to finish your chocolate chip muffin. More uncomfortable feet shuffling. I had a quiz. I had to study for a quiz with a friend for biology. They pinged me during breakfast and asked to meet up before class. Warning logs started flaring up through my system. I've hung around Nori long enough now to have logged and analyzed hundreds of her behavioral patterns and routines. Something was definitely off. What's going on? Is something wrong? I turned around and surveyed the room with her. other than the 30 remaining 7-foot-tall humanoid machines waiting to scan into purgatory, there was no one else down here. No, no, everything's fine, she gushed. Just, it's your big day and all. It's fine, and I'm fine. Nothing to worry about, promise. Okay. So, okay, she responded. I wasn't completely reassured, but I also wasn't detecting any abnormal activity around the bay door area, and the line was quickly coming to an end. I turned back to her. I have to go, I said. Yes, right. As I turned to leave, Nori suddenly grabbed my arm. It's going to be okay, okay? I looked at her, confused. I couldn't possibly see how my impending death could be construed as anything but not okay. But if there's anything I've learned in my years as a bot, it was that most of what humans do or say never made sense. Goodbye, Nori. After I scanned into decommission bay, I was assigned and escorted to a decommission pod, minus two very scary-looking cables. It looked a lot like my charging pod. A reclined seat with a transparent dome for privacy and a monitor attached to the outside base of the pod for human engineers to view real-time analytics. The human who escorted me to my pod instructed me to sit down, then proceeded to plug one of the cables into my LDAP charging point, located at the base of my spine, and the other into the base of my neck that connected to the various data stores that made up my memory module. End to end, the decommission process would take about 5 hours. The first step, the copy step, would take 2 hours of time while all my data transfers over to Stardune's remote servers. Immediately following that, my memory gets wiped clean from my data stores, effectively ending my life as I know it. Then the decommission process officially concludes with the dismemberment of my entire body. Thank God I won't be around for that bit. A couple of minutes ticked by while the human engineer finished setting up my pod. A few more taps here and there on the monitor, then the dome finally shifted down and locked in place with a hiss, sealing my fate with it. Another few minutes came and went before I noticed the daemon copy program began executing on my system. So this was it, the start of the end. For some reason, I expected it to be a bit more exciting. Over the next hour, I monitored the progress of the daemon copy program as it uploaded my data to the remote company servers. To keep my mind occupied, I wrote a script to continuously poll the daemon program every 30 seconds to check its status and update the widget I made to visualize progress. While it was a nice distraction in the moment, I immediately began regretting my life choices the first time the status bar flashed, "You are 41% of the way dead," in bright red letters across my terminal. I thought about deleting it, but what the hell? My entire existence was going to be deleted in about another 45 minutes anyway. At the "you are 68% of the way dead" mark, the copy daemon abruptly terminated at the same time the dim lights illuminating the inside of my pod shut off. 10 seconds later, several humans ran by, yelling and pointing towards the direction of the decommissioned bay entrance. Part of me wondered what all the commotion was all about. But seeing how I was trapped inside this pod, there wasn't much I could do about it. The human would get it sorted out soon enough, and my Grim Reaper daemon would come back online to finish the job. Maybe I should add a burst of confetti to the progress bar once it hits 100% while I wait. Just as I was about to start editing my script, I received a ping from an unknown address. 10-34-45-98-6C. This is Nori Widman. I'm busting you out of here. Sorry I couldn't give you a heads up earlier. Long story. Stand by. 10-34-49-12-5Z. A death progress bar? Seriously? remind me why we're friends again. Captain's Choice by Elliot Rowe. Main power down to 47%. Life support failure in 72 minutes. The klaxon blared out. Well, that's not good. Captain Michael Flynn tapped away at the computer and silenced the alarm. Lieutenant Enders, can you give me more power to life support? I don't know about you, but I quite like breathing. Lieutenant Marcus Enders floated through the engineering airlock and into the main cabin. I don't know what to tell you, Captain, he sighed. The solar storm tried half of our battery cells, which means we're running on a maximum of half the power we should be. But that's not all. He paused. What is it? Captain Flynn said sternly. Well, we have life support for 70 minutes. I can stretch that out to maybe a few hours by closing off sections of the simp and confining the crew. But the bigger issue is we have the habitation pods, the children. The SS Genesis was the first Earth-made FTL generational ship, a vessel designed for deep space travel and loaded with a special cargo of 250 children and their parents who are currently placed in suspended animation with the express purpose of taking over control of the ship and the eventual planetary colony the Genesis was designed to set up. The captain felt his stomach drop. How long? Enders swallowed. About 90 minutes before the cryogenic system start to fail. Flynn moved toward a wall panel and spoke into a radio. Senior staff to control immediately. All other personnel report to the habitation zone. Repeat, all non-essential personnel report to the habitation zone immediately. A few moments later, Commander Lydia Jensen, XO of the Genesis, and Lieutenant Commander Kamala Yurik, the navigator, floated into the control room. Enders explained the situation again, outlining the nature of the situation. I've worked out, he said, if we jettison one of the Psi labs, the kitchen area, and the gym, we can reduce the engines to about 60% capacity. We can also cut the power to the lights and the heat in non-essential areas, which will stretch the life support to about 8 hours. But it still doesn't help us with cryodeck. What about spacesuits? Asked Kamala. We confine non-essential personnel to the habitation zone, and we kill the life support to the control room and engineering. And we just survive in the spacesuits and divert all the rest of the power to the cryodeck. Lydia shook her head. The spacesuits only have about 3 hours of air each. They're designed for spacewalks, not long-term use. Plus, they're practically useless for us to actually use any internal systems. Flynn looked through the observation window toward cryodeck. 250 children, plus the parents. He'd spent 5 years escorting them across the stars. He knew every name. The colonists are the priority, he said glumly. We all knew it when we signed up for this mission. We have to keep them alive at all costs. He fell silent for a moment, considering, and then spoke again. Ulrich, we're still several years from our intended final destination. Are there any other planets en route we can change to? Anything at all? Ulrich moved toward her station. Not currently, she replied. We're in the middle of nowhere right now. The nearest planet is maybe 10 months, and that's with FTL floating at full capacity. At 60%, like Enders suggested, we're looking at 16 months. Flynn sighed. Well, we're not marking any progress floating here talking. We're down to an hour now. Ulrich, Enders, make preparations to jettison the sections we discussed. Jensen, speak to the rest of the crew and make sure they understand what's happening. Be ready to move everyone to the habitation zone and deactivate life support everywhere except the control room, and there in 15 minutes. Yes, sir, the crew responded in unison, moving out of the control room. Flynn floated over to his chair and strapped himself in, closing his eyes. There had to be a way to fix this. He found his mind wandering. What would Captain Kirk do? The thought made Flynn smile despite himself. He'd spent half his childhood watching old science fiction reruns and imagining himself on the bridge of the starship. But then the captain always found a way to save the day in 45 minutes. He was finding out firsthand that real life wasn't nearly so simple. "Captain, ready to jettison," came Ender's voice over the comms. "Make it so." Another Star Trek reference the crew had teased him about the first time he'd used it. "Sir, if we're all going to die soon, I just want to point out that Stargate is much better than Star Trek." Flynn smiled. "Noted, Lieutenant. Now get back up here, please. I'd much rather not die, if only so I can tell you exactly why you're wrong." Enders entered the control room. "There is one thing I've thought of," Enders said quietly. Flynn looked up. "Spit it out, Lieutenant." Enders hesitated. "The FTL reactor has a manual override. We can force the drive into overload for a few hours, give us a boost to our systems. I'll need to confirm with Ulrich, but I think we can cut the transit time from 10 months to maybe 6, he swallowed. "It'll burn out the FTL drive permanently, but we can reroute the excess power back through life support and the cryo deck. It should be able enough to stabilize everything." Flynn leaned forward slightly. "There's an awful lot of should in there, Lieutenant. How confident are you?" Enders glanced down at his data pad. "It's never been done before, so I can't give you any degree of certainty other than it's technically possible." The ship creaked faintly around them, as if reminding them that time was still moving, even if they weren't. "Why didn't you mention this before?" Flynn asked. Enders didn't answer immediately. "Because of what it takes to do it," he said finally. "The system is normally computer-controlled. The storm fried that layer. Someone has to manually climb into the reactor housing to engage the physical override." He looked up. "And stay there while it runs. The radiation suits aren't designed for more than maybe a 15-minute exposure. This will require someone to hold the reactor open while we jump. That's exposure no human can survive." Silence fell again. Ender's words hung heavy in the air. Ulrich and Jensen entered the control room. "Everyone is ready," Jensen said, then paused as she felt the weight in the air. "What's happened?" Flynn didn't look away from the console. "Enders has found a solution," he said. "It's not ideal." He explained it in simple terms, no embellishment, no technical optimism, just the facts. When he finished, neither Ulrich or Jensen spoke immediately. Then Jensen shook her head slightly. "No." Ulrich didn't even try to hide her expression. "So," Flynn said quietly, "I've made my decision." That got their attention. He finally looked up. "I'm going." The protest came instantly, both of them speaking at once. Flynn raised his hand. "I don't want to argue about this," he said. "My decision is final." He turned slightly toward Enders. "Lieutenant, make the preparations." Then to Ulrich. "Go with him. Help get things ready." "Commander," he looked at Jensen. "Stick around. We have a few things to work out." Enders and Ulrich left, leaving Finn alone with Jensen. "Michael, Jensen," spoke but trailed off, unable to find the right words. "Don't say anything," Flynn replied quietly. "It needs to be done. There's no other way. What kind of captain would I be if I wasn't willing to do this for my crew, for the colony? He paused as the words stuck in his throat. "Once it's done, you're the captain. I'll transfer my command codes to you now. Your only objective is to keep the colony safe, get them to a planet." Jensen nodded. "Now," he said, "do you mind if I have a moment alone?" Jensen nodded again. "Of course, sir," she said, and left the control room. Flynn laughed to himself as he floated alone in the control room. For the first time since the alarm sounded, there were no more decisions to be made. After 5 years, this was how it ended. No drama or glory, just a maintenance hatch and a broken rector. He made his way over to the captain's chair again, entered his command codes, and transferred full command control to Jensen. Then he opened up the video log and began recording. "Ship's log, day 2078. This will be my final log as captain of the Genesis." Flynn made his way down to the engineering deck. On his way down, he passed through the habitation zone where the rest of the crew were gathered. No one spoke as he floated through. No cheering, no applause, as if no one really knew how to react. He reached the engine room and was greeted by Jensen, Enders, and Ulrich next to the reactor. Enders pointed inside. "You can see the override switch on the far back wall. That needs to be locked in the down position. That'll begin the power override. Your rad suit will protect you for the first 15 minutes, and maybe a little past that, but full transfer takes at least 35 minutes. Once the override is complete, we'll get a boost to the engines, and we can transfer the power to the life support and cryo deck." Flynn nodded silently. Flynn put on the rad suit and floated towards the reactor hatch, pulling himself inside and made his way over to the override switch. "Ready on your mark," came Ender's voice over the comms. Flynn took a breath. He'd always wondered what he'd say if it ever came to this. A funny line, a witty retort like in the movies. Instead, he opted for a simple, "Do it." He pulled down the lever. At first, he felt nothing. The rad suit was doing its job. Ender's voice came through the comms. "Power transfer at 9, 12, 17. The minutes ticked by slowly. His rad suit gave out an exposure warning. This was it. "Power transfer, 27%, 36%. The suit finally stopped its warning. Flynn started to feel hot, and his body began to ache all over. "Transfer at 68%, 74%, 83%. His head was pounding, his skin was itching. 89%, 94%. "Transfer complete. You did it, Captain." Cheers echoed through the radio, but Flynn barely heard them. He felt dizzy and disoriented. He called out one final time. "Enders?" "Yes, sir." "You're still wrong about Stargate." "Yes, sir." Enders let out something between a laugh and a sob, and then silence. "Sir?" "Captain?" "Michael?" 6 months later, the Genesis was no longer a ship. It was a colony. The ship completed the FTL jump as planned, and as predicted, burned out the engines in the process. From there, it was a simple task to bring the life support and cryodeck back to full power. Now, 6 months on, the first structures were being built, prefabricated houses, greenhouses, schools, a future slowly being assembled, a new world taking shape. At the center of it all stood a name painted across the main habitation block. Flynn Base. Humanize This by Annalisa M. "It appears that your paper is 81% written by AI," wrote the professor's AI to Robert. "As you should be aware from the syllabus, there is a 29% limit of AI usage in any term papers. You may resubmit a revision of your paper within 48 hours or accept a failing grade. A failing grade may result in the loss of your scholarship." But I didn't use AI to write the paper, Robert insisted to his roommate. I wrote the entire thing myself. I didn't even spell check it. If you're too technically proficient, you can get a false positive, Dom said. I've heard about that happening. Just petition the professor. Robert wrote a note to the professor challenging the falling grade, and he immediately received back. It appears your note was written by an AI. Professor Falwell does not respond to AI-written missives. I didn't use AI to write the note about not using AI to write a paper, Robert fumed. How do you get past these chucking robots? Did you try to humanize your text? What are you talking about? There are multiple programs available. You put your AI-written paper through it, and it will humanize the text for you. A robot will make my paper human? That's not what it's intended. But in your case, I think you might need to. Robert processed the information. His term paper was on the symbiotic relationships that mimicked human relationships. He'd included references to the new wave of human-robot marriages and the fact that there were some electronic devices that were indecipherable from their human counterparts. Confused by why the AI was sure it was AI-written, he reread the opening of his paper. Do you remember a time before robots? Most modern people don't. We have integrated with the robots to such a degree that the pre-robot era feels as musty and archaic as a museum exhibit of dinosaur skeletons. However, back in the mid-80s, the impending robot revolution was touted as one that would save time for humans. This was a conscientious effort done in a way to assure human beings that they were not replaceable. Humans would program robots with jobs that breathers believed were beneath them. Robots would free up humans for more creative endeavors. The cheerleaders for the robot revolution provided and promised the humans that robots were after tasks, not jobs. They pointed out that ATMs had not replaced bank tellers, although in a deeper dive, that was not entirely true. ATMs did replace many bank tellers, and ultimately many of the remaining bank tellers were replaced by robot lookalikes. Unfortunately, or fortunately to the very wealthy, ultimately what commerce looked for was robots who could take on 30% of human tasks. And as soon as that leap was made, three humans in a business would be let go, and a fourth human would be given an extra 10% of work. In spite of the promises made that the humans would be focusing on creativity, often described as a time to learn to play the cello, it turned out that nobody in power really wanted creative humans. Sadder than that, most humans, studies have shown, are not inclined to be particularly creative. The idea that time equals creativity is one that was almost immediately disproven by Jensen Frederick et al. Also, few people harbor a sudden desire to learn the cello. What did happen was that robots were taught to play the cello and run marathons and paint pictures. With time, some of the robot engineers began creating robots not to take over jobs in the workplace, but to serve more as companions to humans whose jobs had been replaced. These robots were humanoid, the expensive ones were passable, and they could be seen out and about in the real world as much as in the cubicles. These robots began life as blanks and were given personalities by their owners. They were programmed to think they were human, and nothing could dissuade them from their beliefs. They ate food, exercised, had thoughts. To Robert, the essay read as human. It was colloquial. It started with a bang. He didn't feel that it dragged or was too reliant on mind numbering statistics. Finally, he typed a note. He wrote that he himself, Robert A. Winston Jr., had written the term paper on the sociological study of humans' inexplicable fixation with robotic interactions. His paper covered all aspects of robot-human relationships. He'd gone deeper than the simple cynical relationship in which students were currently using AI to write papers for professors who used AI to grade papers, so that the students learned nothing and the professors did no work. Robert waited the length of a breath, and then he pressed the button to check to see if a robot thought a robot had written the note he'd just written. "This appears to be 99% AI written," was the instant reply. He paced in his small bedroom. He turned off his light and lay down on his twin bed. The glow in the room came entirely from his computer screen. He lit a joint and blew perfectly executed smoke rings to the ceiling. He had been taught by Zach, the older brother of a friend of Dom's. He'd spent what had felt like hundreds of hours trying to make the rings perfect. He got up and reread his note. "Humanize," responded Robert. In seconds, the computer suggested a revise. Now was the big question. Could a robot humanize the work well enough to fool another robot? He began to rev up then, to get increasingly hot. The purpose of the humanoid robots wasn't what the original creators of the robot revolution had envisioned. These bots were available for lonely people. They sometimes had jobs that were beneath what they were designed for, like at an ice cream parlor or taking tickets at a movie theater. They went to college. They texted their girlfriends or boyfriends. But even the best-designed bots could glitch out. Dom smelled the smoke from where he was drinking a beer on the balcony. At first, he thought it was just Robert getting stoned again. But when he caught a whiff of the melting plastic beneath the marijuana, he came into Robert's room and unplugged him. Before by Derek M. Dumican. 1. Wreckage hissed and clicked in a snow-speckled wintry landscape. A silver sedan, its front end wrapped around a pine, rested in a ditch by a mountain drive. Steam curled from its hood to mingle with the faint mist weaved through leafless trees, drawing a veil across the road. The house at the top of the hill and the car itself. A door squealed, and a man in an unzipped parka staggered out. He wheezed as he moved, fleece-lined boots crunching snow. A gloved hand ran through sparse white hair, and fingers trembled, a result of the crash, not the cold. His legs supported him, and apart from a persistent buzzing in his head, all seemed fine. Fine. Except he couldn't remember what happened. Couldn't remember anything except Bethany? Shaking his head, he dragged himself up onto the road and around to the passenger side. He blinked in the fading light of the day, taking in his surroundings. Trees, ice, fog, house, car. His house? His car? They must be, because the woman in the passenger seat was his wife. Of that he was sure. "Bethany," he repeated, voice frail as he opened her door. "Are you okay?" A moan from the silver-haired woman wrapped in heavy green blanket. No parka, no boots, sneakers and cardigan only, as she responded to his hand on her shoulder. Her head lolled to the side, and he noticed the matted hair and trail of dried blood running down her face to her neck. Her eyelids fluttered, looked at her companion with scarcely a flicker of recognition. Her mouth fell open, lips quivered. "Oh, you're hurt." He undid her belt and used the lever beneath her seat to slide it back. She moaned when he slipped an arm behind her to help her out. "I'm sorry," he said, which seemed appropriate. He was the one who'd been driving. "I don't know what happened. My mind is a muddle. I don't even know where we are." Bethany, her name was definitely Bethany, took his shoulders and fell against him. He craned his neck to see past her, studying the house at the top of the tree-lined driveway that led to it. The road they'd been traveling along when he'd somehow lost control and hit a tree. A quaint two-story building with gabled roof and lights on in some windows. Is that home? The house didn't look familiar, but it had to be where they'd come from. And now that he looked, he saw the door on the plant-lined veranda was standing open. Bethany stiffened, one hand leaving his shoulder to point as she muttered what he knew was his name. Harold. Turning in the direction of her gaze, he saw what she did. A person face down on the tarmac. Another woman, not dressed for the weather, in jeans and loose-fitting shirt, blonde hair splayed out about her head. Oh, no. Did we hit her? Bethany couldn't answer with words. She was wincing, hand moving to head to investigate the source of her pain. She squeezed his shoulder and pushed. Go, check. Then she rested against the car, fir tree motif blanket slipping open. He squinted as he tried to remember. Surely this wasn't his fault. He couldn't have run someone down. But no clarity was forthcoming, so he did as urged. Hello? Are you okay? Boots crunched gravel, heart thudded. The car issued a death rattle and lapsed into silence. Silence like that from the woman he crouched down beside. Hello? A gentle shake, a second hand to Turner. A girl, not woman. Late teens, shirt torn at shoulder, skin white as snow. Her face was scraped, coated in frost. Her eyes were crusted shut, lips blue. When she came to rest on her back, they parted, emitting a wisp of misty breath. She's alive, he shouted, but didn't have to. Bethany had followed and was behind him, holding her blanket, ungloved hands quaking. Why was she dressed like that? The thought struck him. Why didn't she have gloves? Had they left the house in a hurry? Don't shout, she groaned. Cold house, Harold. Bring her house. Between them, the girl moaned. Harold nodded, hunting for memories in the maze of broken mirrors in his mind. Jagged shards reflected images of Bethany in elegant attire, of himself in suits and uniforms, or places they'd been, homes, offices, labs, fragments of a life with no context. House, he agreed. Bethany needed heat. This girl needed a doctor, and he needed answers. Maybe he could find everything there, at home. Carefully, he slipped both arms beneath the girl's prone form, lifted her to his chest, and began the ascent towards the house. Bethany with an arm around him for support as she hobbled along. 2. Harold, struggling with his burden, faltered at the foot of the steps leading up to the veranda, eyeing the open door and foyer beyond. A prickle of suspicion slid from his mind fog, chilling his bones worse than the snow, but Bethany shoved and his reluctance to proceed disappeared. Up the steps he lumbered, wheezing into the house with wife in tow. Snow slid from his parka as soon as he entered. To the left, a well-furnished living room glowed in the light of a crackling fire. To the right, a paneled study shrouded in shadow. Before him, a staircase of dark oak climbed to a second floor, and ahead, a paneled hallway stretched away. At the end of that hall, what looked like an empty cubby stood open, decorated with red wallpaper and crimson carpet. Is this our home? He said, sounding foolish as he stumbled into the living room to deposit his cargo on the settee. I can't remember. Must have hit my head bad. Do you know where we... Behind him a cry, and he spun to see Bethany had collapsed. Darling, he gasped. Quickly to her, he tugged off his gloves and helped her into an armchair by the fire. One maybe he himself had set. Her blanket had slipped off, her face was ashen, and the wound on her head looked worse. Under the hairline at her left temple, he noticed the beginnings of a graze, and when he swept blood-stained strands of hair aside, his mouth fell open. God, that looks like a... He stopped short of saying it. It couldn't be. A deep groove carved into her scalp, congealed blood sealing it shut. No, it must have happened in the car. Harold, she said, crossing her arms and rubbing her shoulders. Blanket. Of course, he said, taking a nice fleece throw from the back of the chair and tucking it around her. Sit, get warm, I'll call for help. He said this as he glanced around the room, unable to locate the thing he was seeking. No phones, old or new. "I don't know," Bethany said while Harold's roaming eyes paused at some photos on the mantel. "Can't remember either." The photographs confirmed what Harold knew. This was their home, pictures of the two of them, happy, loving, laughing. A large central portrait, several small ones alongside. He turned to his wife when what she'd said registered. "You can't?" She stared blankly, and he imagined if she hadn't been shivering, he'd have seen her head shake. "How can we both not?" The girl on the sofa inhaled sharply, and he spun to see her sit up, pale blue irises darting wildly. "Before," she spat, color seeping back into her lips. "Steady," Harold said, holding his hands out to convey he wasn't a threat. "You're okay. I'm going to call a doctor. When I find a phone, do you know what happened? I'm so sorry. Did we..." He stopped, afraid to admit anything. The pale-faced girl, shivering and crossing her arms like Bethany, was scanning the room, its navy wallpaper, bay window, mustard-colored drapes, bronze-framed prints, expansive fireplace. Her eyes were wide, lips trembling. "Before," she said again, inspiring a sense of deja vu. "Before what?" Harold asked, stepping closer. She seemed somehow familiar, this blonde girl. "I'm sorry, have we met before?" Her eyes darted back to him and seemed to peer into his soul. What he interpreted as an accusatory glare made him look away, gaze diverted to a tall boy adorned with more photos. These displaying younger folk, a teenage boy and girl, and the girl. He squinted. Yes, it was her. Pretty, blonde, petite. Was she his daughter? "Phone," he said, suddenly reminded of the urgency. His confused wife had a head injury that needed attention. His equally bewildered-looking maybe daughter might be suffering internal bleeding. And what about him? Temporary. Amnesia. "Let me find a phone." He didn't look at her again, couldn't, felt terrible shame. He left the living room, crossed to the door of the study, let his hand drift to the light switch he knew was inside, stopped before pressing it. Someone was there. When his eyes fell on the shape in the shadows of one corner, he yelped and jerked his fingers from the switch. "Who's there?" he shouted. And a misshapen form surged to life. Drawn curtains prevented him from making out detail as he backed away from the room. He thanked his stars. Whoever, whatever that was, its limbs were longer than they should have been, and its head, body proportions were wrong. It reminded him of a pumpkin-headed scarecrow with insufficient straw in shirt and trousers. It also carried, as he saw as it neared the field of light spilling in from the hall, a fireplace poker. "Stay back," he cautioned, though he didn't expect it to listen, and before he could think to look for a weapon, a scream from behind made him turn. It was the girl, on her feet, pointing at the bay window, and the mutated thing outside sliding against it. He knew what he saw, but he couldn't understand it. Bipedal, stubby arms, more shapeless than the thing in the study. Its upper body and head was a wart-covered lump. Its facial features, like something by Salvador Dali. "Bethany," he hissed. She hadn't seen it, was alternating her gaze between him and the girl, brow furrowed, fresh blood leaked from the gut on her head. Harold couldn't comprehend what was happening, but his first instinct was to get his companions to safety. His second instinct was to do it faster, when movement to his left made him turn to the open front door, where a House of Mirrors replica of the girl from the road was peering in. "Before?" she said, or asked, voice grating. Like the one in the study, her arms dangled almost to the ground, body and legs gangly and stick-thin, no fireplace poker. This one held a bloody knife. "Before?" Like some kind of call and response, the girl in the living room was shouting, dragging Bethany from her chair, pulling her toward Howard. Harold moved too, slamming the front door, turning to meet them as they entered the hall. He thought to check the progress of the thing in the study, but his eyes went instead to the warthead, stub-armed monster slithering on its belly down the stairs. As the girl from the road, who may or may not have seen his daughter, pushed him towards the cubby, he hurried, Bethany beside him, arm around her, pulling her, as before, bundled them into the tiny enclosure. What was she doing? Why were they coming here? There was nowhere to go, and monsters were pursuing. One a disfigured male whose head had almost scraped the ceiling, the other a wriggling torso with a bulbous head sporting clumps of stringy blonde hair. Bethany almost crumbled to the floor, staring at what approached, eyes wide, unable to speak. He held her up while before. What else could he call her? Gestured wildly. At him, at the wall, at the smooth rectangular panel on its surface. He didn't know how. He just knew. He pressed his palm against it, and the elevator door slid shut. 3. 5 seconds later, a subterranean hallway, papered and carpeted like the elevator, lit by crystal chandeliers, opened before them. What's happening? Harold said as the three left the lift. Before in the lead, Bethany clinging to him weakly. What are those things? Who are you? Do you know what this is about? Before looked back, met his gaze, stared, as if she was searching for something. After a second, she shook her head and looked away. Had she lost her memory, too? Perhaps, but then where was she going? Striding down the hall as if with purpose, passing a pair of metal doors opposite each other, both ajar, each containing a small barred windows and keypads in the wall alongside. The buzzing in Harold's head grew louder when he tried to peer into the darkness of what looked like cells. Bethany squeezed his arm, fingers pincing skin through thick parka. He drew her closer, saw her face was stricken with confusion, eyes rigidly fixed on him. Harold, she hissed, voice breaking. Is it you? It's me, he said, patting her hand as a different kind of fear stabbed his heart. She needed a doctor. It's going to be okay, I promise. She didn't stop staring, as if seeing him for the first time. It was unnerving, and he felt inexplicable shame, like he had when the girl stared before. Before, why before? He looked forward to see they'd arrived at the end of the hall, and the girl was pushing open a door. Where are we? What's going down here? Motion-activated fluorescent light bulbs in the room beyond flickered to life. Before stood aside to let Harold guide Bethany through, and that's when the flimsy firmament he'd been balancing on collapsed. Bethany screamed, a blood-curdling scream that shocked him more than the sight of the dead man on the concrete floor of what looked like a makeshift lab. Not just dead, broken, lying in a pool of flesh blood. Face pulverized, neck twisted, throat slit, one remaining eye open and staring. He lay between two silver chairs, which were connected by a spaghetti-like mess of cables to a large console, his arms at awkward angles, his left hand clutching a gun. Strength abandoned Harold, and Bethany slipped away, dropping to her knees on the floor, hands carving trails into the gore surrounding the man, who Harold recognized from the tall boy photos. He staggered backwards, bumped the wall next to the door, which before now came through, stepping around Bethany to stand beside him, and not just her. Harold could only stare, speechless, as two more entered, a boy and girl, both blonde, both teens, the image of before and the one on the floor, but for slightly crooked features. He clutched his chest as his heart threatened to explode. Bethany sobbed over the body, shoulders shucking. He wanted to go to her, but was frozen. You got them back, slurred the male, swinging a hammer. Great job. Yeah, lips the girl, the twin of before, snipping the surgical scissors she held. She looked at Harold and smirked. You took the wrong one. Lucky four awoke and let us know who she was before. She let her slipping scissors do the talking. Let's get her in the chair, said the male. Then we can put this behind us. Harold stepped from the wall as the newcomers approached Bethany. Don't, he started, but before he stepped in front of him. "It's okay," she said, grasping his shoulders. "You'll settle. When my form complements yours." The transfer failed. She panicked. "So I'm still here. You couldn't know. And I'm happy you did what you did. This time it will work. She's weak. I don't understand. It's me, H." She tugged down the front of her shirt, revealing a tattoo on her breast. B4. The buzzing in his head became a scream. Memories assaulted him. Reality changed. And Bethany rose, holding the gun. The gun she'd accidentally been shot with. By him on the floor when he was attacked by the others. Him, her love. Him, before her husband moved him here. Bethany screamed. The gunshot reports in the tiny room were deafening. H4 clamped his hands to his ears, watching B3 and H3 fall. Third-gen bodies containing the minds of the ones whose failed bodies were upstairs with the malformed twos, all of them with shuffled minds. The gun swung his way. Tears streamed from Bethany's eyes. "I remember," she howled. "You let them out. Let them kill my Harold." She was Bethany, but not his, and he couldn't argue. He took a bullet to the head and fell as B4 screamed, knocked her curator flat, found H3's hammer and started banging. Then he was horizontal, his remaining eye lined up with the unseeing eye of his original body. Images from an eventful life flashed before him, of a career in the military with Bethany, of cloning technology, of research into mind transference, of being retired when incidents occurred and laws were passed, of aging, illness, dying, of a replica lab in their basement and trying to recreate success, of 4 attempts at clones and exercises and mind swaps. They weren't his memories. They were inherited and separate from the residuals in Harold's brain, like the plan to destroy all clones when he and his wife took possession of his and B4's bodies, and the keypad combination to the cells. His memories were fewer, extracted from a cylinder with B4, locked in a cell, being transferred into the body of his maker, the memories of a puppet, until his one decision, to rebel, to free himself and the others, to take his love from this place. It nearly worked, but he got the next best thing. B4 would live. Maybe she'd make herself another. And though H5 would never be him, he'd be close.